Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're here for our third and last case for today, 10 AP 1474, Best Price Plumbing, Inc. versus Erie Insurance Exchange. George Love, Counsel Love, representing Best Price Plumbing. You have 25 minutes, sir.
Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is George Love. I represent Best Price Plumbing, Inc. I ask to reserve, 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case is a payment case, and it revolves around payment by an insurance company to an insured. My first point is, when the insured is under contract with the provider, must the insurance company give binding assent to have a direct pay request made by the insured to pay the proceeds to the provider. Turning to my second point, depending solely on whether a document is a negotiable instrument under Chapter 403 of the Wisconsin statutes, we have two different statutes relating to the presumptive validity of a signature once introduced introduced into evidence. My third point is that once the presumption as to the validity of the signature is rebutted under either of the two statutes, depending on the circumstances, then the burden of proof is on the person who is making payment to prove that the signature accepting the check was valid and that the check was in fact delivered. Allow me to turn to my first point. An insured contracts with the provider. There's a second circumstance. The insurance company contracts with the provider. The latter is this case, and the mistake that the Court of Appeals made was to treat this case as a contract between the insured and the provider.
Counselor, would you explain that a little bit further, giving me the background that caused the jury to conclude there was a contract between Erie and Best Price?
The facts that were underlying the verdict, Your Honor, were that there was a water damage frozen pipe loss at 2178 North 74th Street in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, and the owner was a limited liability company known as Wiltrim Group, LLC, and one of the members of that LLC, who had prior dealings with Best Price Plumbing, called in Best Price Plumbing to the job site to look at the problem, and when my client said, who's going to pay for that, Mr. Trimble, called the insurance company, handed the phone to my client, who then, Mr. Darrell Makely, who then asked the insurance company adjuster, Mr. Savinsky, who is going to pay for this, and they said, we are. And then there was an authorization of a $2,000 limit for the repair of the pipes. When that was exceeded, my client went to Savinsky, the adjuster, and asked for an increase. There was a $2,000 increase. And then my client had a third contact with Savinsky, this time to the president, Paul Price, on the job site, and another $4,500 was authorized. And my client then sent the bill to Mr. Savinsky by fax on March 28, 2008, and they cut a check to the insured and to Best Price Plumbing and mailed it to the insured at the insured's request per telephone message as documented in an entry made in Mr. Savinsky's computer records, which are attached to my brief. That's the background as I see it.
Thank you.
Mr. Love?
Yes, please.
In your opponent's brief, she writes, Trevor Trimble, a member of Wiltrim, hired Best Price for plumbing services. And I think I just heard you say that Trevor Trimble did contact.
Face to face, they were on the job site, Trevor Trimble and Mr. Michlich, looking at the damage. And as I stated, the question then arose from Mr. Michlich, who's going to pay for this? And he dialed Savinsky, who then said, we are. And furthermore, in the testimony at trial, Mr. Trimble said that he told the insurance company adjuster that, quote, we want to go with Best.
Mr. Trimble said that.
But that's what the jury found, that the contract was, that there was a contract for these services between Best and Erie. I think that now is, if it isn't a conceded fact, it's a fixed fact. This is the pole star of all future discussion as far as the resolution of this case.
Well, I don't think there's any dispute that, that the jury found that there was a contract between Erie and Best, but that does that finding rule out any other facts, such as Mr. Trimble's...
Such as what? I'm sorry.
Such as Mr. Trimble's contacting Best and approving Best. Were there any other contractors ever in the picture here?
The only thing that was mentioned was that Price Plumbing was going to do the job, and that Erie acknowledged that the price, the Best price charged, which was $8,997, was correct. And under Wisconsin law, the check should have been sent to Best Price Plumbing at their address in Waukesha under the five cases that were cited to the court. And
well, let me ask this. When did Erie know that it was $8,800-some?
When my client sent them an invoice on March 28th, and they then cut the check on the ninth day of April 2008.
That's sort of on the back end of the process, isn't it?
Mr. Savinsky acknowledged that they owed the money in during trial. In the testimony, he even checked with his supervisor. So there was no dispute as to the price, as far as Erie was concerned, and they cut the check. So. I do not feel there are any other contract obligations, and I will get to that in a very short period of time once I get done with this first issue.
Okay.
It is important to note that in the case of Yorkin versus Durkin, a chiropractor attempted to obtain a commitment from a lawyer to pay his bill based on a document signed by the insured. In the Supreme Court of Wisconsin in 2006, Wisconsin 60 denied that. There is a very basic reason that underlies that denial, and it is the fact that in Wisconsin, a claim against somebody else, a creditor can only assign it in the solido as one piece. He cannot break it up. So in the case of Scobus versus the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin and Fergie, in 1899, they built a $50,000 addition to Ladies Hall on the campus, and the prime contractor became embarrassed, and he had made six or seven assignments to his providers. Mr. Scobus was the iron worker, and Mr. Scobus sued the University of Wisconsin. The University of Wisconsin refused to pay, except as one piece. And the court reasoned at 102 WIS 122 that no creditor can divide a claim, fragment it into parts, and assign it to various people. So in this case, without the consent of the debtor, in this case, we have a direction to pay issue, discussion. And in a casualty case, you have multiple providers, plumbers, drywallers, furnace people in this case. And in personal injury cases, you have various medical type providers. And you have one race, one corpus, and the creditor, who is the insured, cannot divide it into pieces. This line of cases was, there are about six of them that are all stating the same thing. The later case of Thiel versus John Weeks Lumber and 137 WIS period 272 says the same thing. So this gets down to the point that if you have a direction to pay, there has to be consent by the insurance company or by the attorney if it's a Durkin-type case.
I have some trouble with this case. If the insurance company made out this check to both the insured and your client, and the insured signed that check and mailed it to you, we wouldn't be here, right?
Mailed it to me?
Mailed it to your client.
If the insured signed the check and mailed it to my client, then there would be payment if my client took the check for the obligation. And, of course, a check is a negotiable instrument. It can be negotiated. And you are absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is not what happened in this
case. So the reason we're here is because that wasn't done. The check was not sent to you. And the check was, whatever happened to it, whoever signed for it, it wasn't your client, and your client didn't get the money, right?
Absolutely.
And my understanding is Erie doesn't have this money either. Is that right?
Who doesn't have his money?
The insurance company.
The insurance company paid the check.
Yeah. They don't have the money.
They don't have the money either.
You don't have the money. Erie doesn't have the money. And so the question is, between two losers, who's going to lose the most?
I have an answer to that question.
I knew you would.
The answer to that question is the classic case of Brooks versus Hayes, in which the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin ruled that an obligor can delegate the performance of an obligation, but it cannot delegate the responsibility for that obligation. When Erie mailed the check to the insured at the insured's request, the insured was not the agent of my client, and it was no more than putting the check in the mailbox to the home office of Best Price Plumbing. As long as the check did not arrive, it was not payment. There is a specific statute that deals with payment by check, and it is 403.3102(2A). And it provides, its key language is, quote, takes the check for the obligation. Now, a check is a mobile quantity, and if the check never falls into the hands of Best Price Plumbing, there is no payment. Mm-hmm. And of course, the obligor runs the risk of delivery. And we spoke of the two innocent parties. In essence, the insurance company, who had a direct contract with the provider, has self-created the problem by mailing the check to an outside party. And I would point out that insurance in times of casualty are distressed financially, and the temptation is unusually severe to take the proceeds. And it happens. It happens in the case of Jürgen versus Durkin.
It's my understanding, and you should correct me, that the jury heard that the insurance company has a contract with the insured, right? The policy.
They do.
Absolutely.
Yes, they do. We can see that.
And that the insurance company agrees to pay the insured for damages, right? And that what the insurance company was doing was paying the insured under the policy and was paying your client under the contract. That's why it made out the check to two people.
Yes.
Did the jury hear that?
The jury heard that, but whether the insurance company had a customer or didn't, it had a unilateral, single-minded obligation to Best Price Plumbing to pay it for its work.
Okay, and so it's my understanding your position is, as a matter of law, nothing to do with the jury, as a matter of law, Erie owed your client this money because it had a contract with your client. And regardless of the insurance policy, as a matter of law, Erie had to pay your client. And until it does, it remains liable.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your position, as a matter of law.
It is a matter of law, and furthermore, if I mail a check to a creditor, and it happens countless times in the course of history, and the check doesn't get there, there's no payment. It has to fall into the hands of the creditor. It has to be, quote, taken by the creditor.
Well, I could have mailed, Erie could have mailed a check to Best Price Plumbing, and Best Price Plumbing could have had an employee who took all checks and deposited it into his own personal account, right?
Yes, and that is also covered by the law because there are two cases. One of them is if the check falls into the hands of the provider and it is embezzled by an employee, the Erie is absolved. And that and there are two cases on that score. One is the Ripon Knitting Company case at 207 West 452, and the other one is the Zuma case versus Polisic at 199 West Period 529. And in section 403.403, it says that an unauthorized signature means nothing unless the payor paid it in good faith. They all mean the same thing. If the check falls into the hands of an agent who either has express, implied, or apparent authority, then the to collect accounts, then Best is bound by it, and the Ripon Knitting Company case is the best explanation of that rule, and that is that once the check passes into the employer's hands, obviously the embezzlement was not authorized, mm-hmm. but the law provides that the payee becomes responsible.
Here the embezzlement, and I put that in quotes because that's not proved, the embezzlement just was at an earlier stage.
The embezzlement... it's just a code word for misconduct.
Okay. It was the misconduct was at an earlier stage.
Yes. Now,
it was not misconduct by a Best Price employee or principal, correct?
It is not misconduct by Best Price's employee.
Well,
I guess my concern was whether there was any testimony that a Best Price employee signed the check, and that employee had the authority to, in essence, authorize payment in this fashion rather than payment directly to Best Price.
Well, there was conflicting testimony. Best Price's three principals denied the signature, and Mr. Trimble testified that he gave the check to a certain handyman by the name of Abdul, who was obstructed to go to the job site 2 weeks after my client had finished the job and get a signature, and he returned with the signature. So this was hotly contested as to whose signature this was.
It may be hotly contested as to whose signature it was. I got that from your briefs. What I didn't see anywhere was whether whose ever signature this was, that person had the authority to modify the contract between Erie and Best Price, that Erie would pay Best Price for the work.
Best Price has three principles. The payment comes through the mail into the coffers of the company at the address, and the risk of loss then ceases to be that of Erie Insurance Company. Now, we have to remember, that is, Best Price Plumbing has to remember, is that after a month had passed when the check issued, Savinsky called Mr. Trimble and said what happened, and Mr. Trimble said, well, I know that Best Price has not been paid. That was what Mr. Savinsky wrote down right on the very same day, and he said, I have an employee by the name of Chandra who has taken checks and signed checks, and I'm looking for her. He didn't say anything about Abdul, and when the Abdul story came at the time of trial, Mr. Trimble was very much a participant in that sequence because Mr. Trimble gave the check to Abdul, left the job site, told Abdul to wait for two fool providers to arrive and sign the check and make a gift. There was no indication on the record of the desire of anybody to make a gift to Mr. Trimble, and I refer the court in that case to the case of Cushman versus the State of Cushman, 213 Whispered 74. They look at such things when there is an embezzlement.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals and talked about conflicting testimony, the kind of testimony that you're referring to, this phone call where notes were taken about Chandra and other conflicting testimony. And ultimately, the Court of Appeals says that there was conflicting testimony before the jury about, number one, how Best Price was supposed to be paid, and number two, about how the Best Price signature came to be on the check. And I read the Court of Appeals then to say, look, there's conflicting testimony on these key issues. Standard is whether there's any credible evidence. There's credible evidence. We're going to defer to the jury.
I have an answer for that question. But the Court of Appeals really said was, quote, at page 4, Best conceded. It did not, pardon me. This is the quote at page 4. Trimble testified that the check was endorsed by a Best Price employee, end quote. But there is not a shred of evidence on the record that Mr. Trimble recognized the sacred signature of Best Price, that Mr. Trimble saw Best Price sign it, or that Abdul told Trimble that he saw Best Price sign the check and the HAVC contractor simultaneously signed the check. In other words, this is a no credible evidence case on the signature because there is nobody from Erie who has stated that Best Price actually signed the check based on credible evidence. And the way signatures are proved up are through comparison documents, or through experts, or through witnessing. And in the case of Jacks versus Jacks, which is 73 Wisp period 572, the Supreme Court said that mere denials are not enough in a negotiable instrument case. They have to show more than mere denials. And Mrs. Jacks had suppressed the signature. The lawyer who drafted the note under the attorney-client privilege in that case has been, cited numerous times for that principle. But in this case, we have a case where Mrs. Jacks denied she ever got the money. But in this case, Mr. Trimble got the money. He said a very different statement 2 years earlier when he talked to the adjuster, namely that Chandra took the check. And there is no evidence. I have pointed out to the court that all Mr. Trimble ever said was that Abdul was there. Abdul was there. He never said Abdul saw them sign it. He never said Abdul told him he signed it. What he said was that either Paul or Wayne would be the ones who would sign it. But Paul or Wayne weren't there for over 2 weeks. And on top of that, it doesn't say that they did sign it. He was, in essence, was saying they would have authority to sign it, and I trust they were the only names he knew anyways.
Is the Court of Appeals incorrect in that sentence that you referred to in paragraph 9 on page 4 when it says Trimble testified that the check was endorsed by a Best Price employee? Is the Court of Appeals incorrect?
It was incorrect. There was not one scintilla of evidence on the record that would allow Mr. Trimble to testify, and he didn't testify. It was their signature. He said he told Abdul to get it.
I think the transcript in this one-day trial is about 100 pages, and I have not yet read it. But you're telling me if I go through that 100 pages, I am not going to find that Trimble testified that the check was endorsed by a Best Price employee. Is that correct?
That's right. And I, in my brief, went through every one of his statements and gave references to where Mr. Trimble testified that all he ever really said over and over again was Abdul was sent to the job site or told to stay at the job site until Best appeared. Now, I would point out one other thing, Your Honor. Every check I've ever signed, except when my wife is signing, I sign first. And I don't know how somebody from Best Price could have signed on the top and had exactly the same left to right slant as Will Trim Group has of a left-handed writer. And you have four exemplars in the record of notes written by Daryl Mickley, of a signature by Paul Price in which he excoriated Erie for not paying them, and you have the notes of Paul Price, and you have Debbie Mickley's signature on the proposal. It's an issue of fact whether or not a signature is the signature, is a genuine signature of a particular individual, and whether there was authority for the signature, in other words, to take the check in the case of an entity. But I am stating to you that there is no evidence on the record, and I have read the record many times, that says that Trevor Trimble said this was their check based on what anybody saw or compared with the signatures.
So you say the sentence, Trimble testified that the check was endorsed by a Best Price employee, is wrong.
Yes, I say that.
Okay.
Now, let's get back to the presumption about signatures. Under the Uniform Commercial Code, once that signature is propounded into evidence, not only does there have to be a denial in the pleadings, there has to be evidence introduced by Best, the person opposing the admission of the signature, that would sustain a finding to the contrary. And I state to you that when you take the Chandra statement, when you take Trevor Trimble's statement on the 5th day of March, as recorded by Mr. Savinsky, that he knows that Best was not paid, when you take the fact that Mr. Trimble put the money into his account, and in Jack's, the Supreme Court made a big issue of that. They had no idea where the money went. And when you take the fact that nobody saw, when you take those items standing alone, as a matter of law, they are able to sustain a finding that if they're believed, there was no signature by Best Price. And then the burden shifts for, as a matter of common law, to prove the signature up by Erie. Erie has to prove the signature up. And It's true under 891.25. It's true under 403.3081. And by the way, I'd point out to you that when Jax was written, the statutes had a different numbering. It was 403.3071, but now it's 08. And a very nice case for proof of payment. In this case, it was a receipt in 1943, was the case of Toma versus Mineral Film Health Bath Company, 244, WISP period 347, in which they clearly say once the check is rebutted under 891.25, admittedly, but nevertheless rebutted, the burden of proof falls on the person who wants the signature admitted. Now,
Mr. Love, your red light has been on for several moments. It means your time is up.
My time is up? Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. And you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Alyssa M. Bolin, Attorney Bolin, representing Erie Insurance Exchange. Counsel?
Thank you. Good afternoon. There are two key facts that are of the utmost importance in this case. First, there is not a written contract between the parties that can be interpreted. Rather, this case involves a verbal contract that was found to exist by the jury and the interpretation of that verbal contract. Second, this case was tried to a jury, and we have a jury determination not only as to the existence of the contract, but also a determination that Erie did not breach the contract. Therefore, when Erie issued its two-party check, it complied with the payment term, which term was testified to by Wayne Savinsky and found to exist by the jury. Therefore, the contract is not silent as to the method or place of payment. The existence of a verbal contract and its terms are for the jury to determine. The rule, as stated by the Becker Court, is that the jury has the right to determine the existence of the parole contract and its extent and limitations. They are to find not only what language was used, but its purport and meaning. The Becker Court reasoned, and it seems to be well settled, that the question as to what the party said and did in making the verbal contract and what they understood thereby is single and cannot be separated so as to refer one part to the jury and another to the court. But in its entirety, the question is one of fact. In this case, Best Price seeks to separate the questions of the existence of the contract from the question of breach so as to refer one question to the jury and one question to the court.
Counselor, I'm looking at the invoice that Best Price sent, and the invoice was sent on March 25th, 2008. It was sent for the amount of the check that Erie wrote. The top of that invoice says terms, 30 days, 1.5% per month, parent, 18% per annum. Interest will be charged on the unpaid balance after 30 days. All costs of collection, including attorney's fees, shall be paid by the purchaser. Doesn't that give you any indication that Best expected to be paid by Erie, to whom they sent this invoice?
Erie did issue payment to Best Price. Erie issued payment to Best Price in conformance with its standard industry practices.
Why didn't Erie just send it to Best Price and let Best Price go see the owner of the property for the second signature? Why send it to the owner of the property who didn't contract with Best Price?
Wayne Savinsky in this case testified that an insurance company has a manner of payment, and there's three ways in which
insurance company had a contract with an organization to do plumbing. The jury found that, and you haven't contested it, so that's where I'm starting. So the provider had a contract with the insurance company. Whatever the insurance company's theory of payment to his insured is not part of that contract. And it seems to me that's what you're saying to me that it is. Can you explain to me where my thinking is off the track and somehow what you seem to say is your agreement with the insured somehow should be part of the contract with Best Price?
The fact that this case arose in an insurance situation cannot be overlooked. You can't overlook the fact that Erie had obligations to its insured and was only in this situation because of the obligations to its insured. And so the fact that Erie had an obligation to pay Best, as determined by the jury, is only because Best Price performed work for its insured. When we tried this case to a jury, the existence of the contract was disputed. The jury heard evidence regarding whether or not there was the existence of the contract and its terms. The jury heard testimony regarding Erie's payment practices. Those payment practices of the insurance company had to be incorporated into the contract that the jury found to exist.
Why? Maybe the jury thought that the signature was the signature of someone who had the authority to change the terms of payment.
The jury heard testimony that for Best Price to get paid directly, it had to request a direction to pay. There is no dispute that Best Price did not request a direction to pay. Therefore, the only other testimony the jury heard was regarding Erie's payment practices.
Didn't the jury have before it? It says Exhibit 22. I don't know if that's from a deposition. It also says Exhibit 28. So I assume the invoice was an exhibit that was used maybe in two places, maybe depositions and at trial. But the jury had this invoice, didn't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The invoice was before the jury. The invoice was unsigned. Best Price has not represented that that is a written contract before the parties. And so we're left with a verbal contract where the existence of and the terms of the contract are to be found by the jury. Here the jury had to use the same pool of evidence. You can't use the testimony to find the existence and then disregard that same testimony, which includes the payment practices regarding payment, the issuance of the three-party check, the two-party check, the direction to pay, the two-party check, and issuing a check to the insured and its contractor, and negate that if you're using it to find the existence. In this case, the jury heard that testimony, and it incorporated that testimony into the contract between Erie and Best Price, which is evidenced by the jury's finding of no breach.
Well, I think that what the trial court did is it looked at the invoice and decided cutting a check in accordance with the invoice, if there were an oral contract, certainly ratified it, correct?
I honestly did not hear the first part of your question.
Okay. The trial court set aside the answer to one of the questions, and that's whether there was a breach. And the trial court says, as a matter of law, essentially there wasn't payment here because there wasn't payment on the invoice, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So when the trial court made that finding, certainly it was with the check cut in exact compliance with the invoice, was, if nothing else, ratifying as a matter of law that this is what payment required, correct?
The trial court applied the law if a contract is silent as to the place of payment. If there is absent legitimate inferences to the contrary, payment is to be made at the home office of the payee if within this state. Mm-hmm. The trial court found credible evidence to exist in the testimony of Wayne Savinsky, his testimony regarding the payment practices, mm-hmm. and applied that to a contract which was not before the jury. He applied that to the contract between Erie and Best Price. In this case,
the contract between Erie and Best Price was not the contract before the jury?
The jury was asked to determine the existence of one contract, whether or not a contract existed between Best Price and Erie.
Okay.
In determining whether or not a contract existed between Best Price or Erie, the jury heard regarding Erie's obligations to its insured, that Erie was called to the premises because its insured had property damage, that Erie was there to see whether or not it was a covered loss. And so in determining whether there was a contract before Best Price and Erie, a question on the verdict, the jury heard testimony regarding Erie's obligations to its insured.
Did the jury decide there was a contract between Best Price and Erie?
Yes.
Okay. So the jury said there is a contract between Best Price and Erie.
Yes.
But then the jury said there was not a breach of that contract.
Exactly.
What the jury essentially said is you can have a contract to accept services, but you don't have to pay for them.
What the jury said is that we find the payment term to be you can satisfy your obligations under the contract by acting in conformance with your industry practices, by sending a two-party check to your insured.
Was there any testimony in the record by anyone that Erie, when it was approving first $2,000 of work and then upping it to $4,000 and then upping it yet a third time, that Erie told Best Price, our industry practices are, we're paying for this, but we're paying for it by sending the check to our insured? Was there any testimony about that?
The record, it doesn't have any direct conversations regarding the payment term. However, it must be remembered that the jury did find no breach, and the Erie's one obligation in this contract was to issue payment.
Right, I know that. That's what's troubling me, is that was the only thing they were supposed to do. Best Price was supposed to do the plumbing. They did the plumbing, so they performed. But they didn't get paid, and they were supposed to pay. And what you're telling me is, well, the jury heard industry practices are thus and so. Well, that may be industry practices, but if you're going to have it be part of this contract, both parties have to agree to it. A contract is a meeting of the minds. So how can Best Price have a meeting of the minds to accept payment sent to another person as part of the contract unless there's some testimony? Yeah, that's what the parties agreed.
Employees of Best Price were asked, did you sign a direction to pay? No, we did not request direct payment.
That wasn't my question, Counselor. My question is there testimony in the record that in any conversation between Erie and an employee of Best Price, Erie told them that we were going to pay by standards in the insurance industry, which means we are going to send our payment to our insured for your work?
There is not a conversation to that effect.
Okay, that's all I want to know.
Can I ask a related but different question then? You have a contract between Best Price and Erie. Best Price does the work. Erie says they'll pay. Erie now says, well, we paid someone else, so that's just like paying you. The jury apparently hears about their practice of issuing two-party checks. But was the jury also instructed that when a contract does not state or when it's silent as to the place of payment, then the place of payment is the payee's business?
The jury was not instructed regarding the law as cited by the Kenosha Home. Best Price had the opportunity to request an instruction to that effect and failed to request that instruction.
Was there any objection to the instructions?
No.
What was your argument to the jury? I mean, was the argument to the jury by Erie that Erie knew it was that Best Price knew it was dealing with an insurance company, knew it was dealing with the insured, that it had spoken to both the insured and the insurance company, and that it had sent the bill to the insurance company, was your argument that it knew dealing with an insurance company practice was that you got a check made out to both? What was the argument on the basis of all this evidence that was conflicting?
First, our argument was that there was no contract,
okay,
and that if the jury would find a contract to exist, that Erie performed its obligations under the contract to issue payment by issuing a two-party check in conformance with its standard industry practice.
And what was the counter-argument of Best?
That there was a contract.
There was a contract, and the contract's terms were what?
It had to issue payment.
Only to Best?
No, that it had to, and Attorney Love can correct me if I'm wrong, that it had, Erie didn't satisfy its obligations because it sent, Best Price never got paid. I think your point before was, who's the biggest loser because you both didn't get paid?
That's right.
And Best's argument was, we didn't get paid. The money is not in our account. The money is not in Erie's account. you're required to pay us.
Well, if it said there was a contract, and I will ask this to Mr. Love, since Mr. Love's client's position was there was a contract, he had to state what the terms of the contract were, or at least argue what they were. And was the argument that payment was to be made only to Best and had to be sent to the Best's headquarters?
No.
What was his argument?
The argument was that we didn't get paid.
Period.
Right.
Was promised to pay us and we never got the money.
Right.
Isn't the argument that when a contract is silent as to place of payment, then the place of payment has to be Best Price Plumbing?
That is the law as cited by Kenosha Home, additionally with a legitimate inference to the contrary provision in the law. However, that was not argued to the jury at trial. That was argued on motions after verdict to the circuit court.
That is the law, and see, that's, I think, the focus. It seems to me that you have what's called the common law default rule, and that comes out of the Kenosha case. And the common law default rule coming out of the Kenosha case that you're talking about is where a contract for the payment of money is silent. So here you have a contract. And Erie has to pay. And where it is silent as to the place of payment, now we get to the important part, in the absence of any legitimate inference to the contrary, the law implies that payment shall be made at the resident's office or place of business of the creditor. So you have that common law default rule that's set forth quite plainly in the Kenosha Holmes case. And so the focus here, the law is, if the contract is silent, you got to pay. And Erie says, we pay. Now the question is, where do you pay? That's what the focus of this case is. Where do they have to pay? Because they pay. They have to pay at the credit, at the at Best's place of business. Except, the exception to that is in the absence of any legitimate inference to the contrary. So the arguments, at least in the briefs, as I understood them in part, was, hey, the jury, this is a factual question. Was there any inference to the contrary? I mean, that's why the signature and who signed it and is signing a check that's made out to two parties by conduct, inference to the contrary. That's the way that I thought the argument was advanced. The problem is the jury wasn't instructed. So what do you do about that? That's the law. That's, in my mind, well-established law. Jury can decide if there is any legitimate inference to the contrary by conduct, by words, I guess. But the jury wasn't instructed, and yet that still is the law to be applied, I assume. What do we do with this failure of a jury to instruct?
It was waived by Best Price for failing to request a jury instruction regarding the place of payment law. And we have a determination by the jury that Erie, that there was a payment term, that Erie complied with the payment term by a finding of no breach.
Counselor,
I ask, your brief says the jury believed that Best Price endorsed the Erie check. And then it said it found that Best Price endorsed the check and accepted payment at a location other than its home office. Do you really believe that?
It's not what I believe, Your Honor. The jury believed that that happened. The jury found no breach and found that Best Price endorsed the check.
Wait a minute. Was there a question that specifically asked whether they found that? I mean, you assert it found that Best Price endorsed the check. Did they find that?
It has to be found because the jury found no breach. And so,
is this essential to a finding of no breach?
The fact that Best Price endorsed the signature,
yeah,
or endorsed the Erie check, It's one part of the credible evidence that supports the jury's finding of no breach. Other credible evidence exists in the form of Wayne Savinsky's testimony regarding the industry practices and how Erie's payment complied with the industry practices.
I mean, but is this an indispensable part of the finding?
Of no breach?
Yeah.
No, Your Honor. I believe the fact that Erie issued payment and having that payment be made and accepted all coincide with the finding of no breach. I don't think without one, you don't have the other.
Yeah, but if the jury's only given half of the story and they're only instructed as to a two-party check and how that works, and they're not instructed that when a contract is silent, you have to pay best price, how do you know those things to be true that you put in your brief? They only got half the story. The jury only was instructed on half of the law or part of the law. I don't follow what you're saying, really.
I believe that the jury found Erie to have performed because it had one performance obligation in this case, to issue payment. And so the question becomes, is the method and the place of payment sufficient?
Yeah, but they were never told of a different method of payment, which is clearly the law.
The jury was instructed regarding breach, though, and the jury was told that if you have performance, defective performance, or not performing at all, you have to find breach. If the jury would have found that Erie's performance was defective or partially defective, it would have found a breach. Here we have a jury determination of no breach.
Counselor, is issuing payment the same as paying?
Yes.
Okay, so I owe you $100, and I write you a check, and I put it in the mail, and you never get it. But I issued payment. Have you been paid?
In this case, Erie issued payment.
Oh, you have to answer my question. Sorry.
It's a hypothetical.
She understands that.
Your Honor, I believe that the payment, when you put it in the mail, and it, does it get to me?
Yeah, right. It gets lost in the mail. Things like that happen. Have you been paid?
I think it would be a factual determination by the jury if we would have a question, bring it to trial.
Do you think the jury can really find you have been paid because I wrote a check and we all agree you didn't get it? Be a funny jury, I think.
But the jury heard testimony that the Best Price didn't request direct payment. And I know I keep coming back to that, Your Honor.
I know, but see, what I'm quarreling with you about, Counselor, is you want to equate 100% issuing payment equivalent to payment. I think they're two different things, as my hypothetical was meant to show. They're not always the same. And that's what I'm stuck on this case. That's the part that's hard for me. I understand your client's position as an insurance company. I understand why they have the processes they have. But what I'm looking at is a contract where one person performed, that was that person's side. The other side was to pay, not to issue payment, but to pay. And that's where we're stuck on this case. Because your client, quote, issued payment, but the other guy wasn't paid. That's the problem.
Then I think we have to go back to, I think, Justice Prosser's question regarding the Best Price endorsement on the check. Best Price introduced into evidence the Erie check reflecting two signatures. And as the Court of Appeals points out, there was conflicting testimony regarding the endorsements on the signature. The jury heard that testimony. Matters of the credibility of the witnesses and the weight given to their testimony is for the jury to determine. And the jury found that there is no breach.
There was no testimony before the jury that Best Price was ever paid, correct?
Best Price claims, and there is no dispute, that Best Price does not have the money. Erie does not have the money.
Well, somebody has the money. I'm surprised the district attorney hasn't been called to find out who has the money, but in any case, that's not this case.
Well, Justice Rogensack's hypothetical would be closer to this case if that check was cashed and her bank account is short $100, and yet the payee didn't have $100. So the question is, there's the loss when the money disappears, and we're assuming that the bank is not liable for that check.
My concern was not so much with that, Chief Justice, as whether payment and issuing payment are really the same thing, because that's what's bothering me. And I understand your argument. It's a good argument. I'm just having trouble figuring out where to go.
Well, they may not be the same, but the point of the matter is, who bears the loss when they're not the same? This has been issued. It's been cashed. It didn't get to the right payee. Now, I assume that the jury was not told. We know they weren't told about the law being that if a contract is silent, it goes to the payee's address. Seems to me the argument went that that here the inference from the best from the practices of the insurance company was that payment would be made to the insured, so that the contract wasn't silent.
Exactly right. We don't believe that the contract was silent as to the place.
If there was a contract, because you didn't think there was a contract.
Exactly. If there is a contract, we don't believe that the contract was silent as to the place of payment, because the jury determined the payment term, and Erie complied with that payment term as evidenced by the no breach.
So but it could be that they thought that the Best had signed the contract, the check, or the jury could have thought that Best was supposed to get a check with double signatures, and that's the compliance of your company.
Right.
And what else could they have thought? I mean, the point is you've got a jury verdict here. Test, according to the Court of Appeals, is there any credible evidence? So there's credible evidence if they thought that the term was pay the insured, right? There's credible evidence if they thought that Best really got the money or that its agent got the money, right? That supports it. What else supports it? Anything else? Any other theory that the jury could have used to say that your client complied with the contract?
The fact that there is the check that exists that's endorsed, which I think you already referenced.
So was there any testimony by anybody that Best Price was told that the check would be sent to the insured?
There was no conversation, direct conversation regarding payment, Your Honor.
Is there any testimony that by Mr. Trimble that the check was endorsed by a Best Price employee?
That's in paragraph 9 that Mr. Love says there's no evidence for. Paragraph 9, is that right? Paragraph 9 of the Court of Appeals decision. Trimble testified the check was endorsed by a Best Price employee.
The testimony in trial is that, were you the one that made the signature regarding the Wiltrum Group?
It was you.
Trevor Trimble.
Okay, go ahead.
Who made the other signature? I believe Best Price Plumbing. It would have been either Daryl or Paul, I believe his name is.
And then
what page of the record is that? I'm sorry.
It's 114.
Okay.
And then it goes on to say, and so Abdul took the check from you and got the signature from Best Price. And the answer is yes.
That he didn't have to go anywhere, that they were on site on the job site, right?
Ms. Bowen, I'm interested in what Judge Boren had to say. Judge Boren changed the answer of the jury here. He basically changed it from no breach to yes, there was a breach. He indicated, as I understand it, that there was not credible evidence to support the answer of the jury. What else did he say? He knew the rule. He knew the fact that you try to sustain the jury verdict if you can. What else did Judge Boren say in changing the answer?
Judge Boren found that while there was credible evidence to exist, he applied it to the contract between Erie and Best Price. Therefore, he found that the contract was silent as to the place of payment. That being the case, it's undisputed that the check didn't get to Best Price Home Office. He applied the Kenosha Home Rule, finding it didn't apply in only venue cases. It was a substantive rule of law, and changed the jury verdict from no breach to breach.
And what's wrong with that reasoning?
We believe that the contract is not silent. Contract is not silent as to the place of payment, based on what I said already. And legitimate inferences exist to have payment be made at a place other than Best Price Home Office. Legitimate inferences exist in the fact that this case arises in an insurance context, and that can't be overlooked. The fact that the jury heard testimony regarding Erie standard payment practices, and that Best Price payment practices when it issues payment to a contractor doing work on its insured's property, and that Best Price never requested a direction to pay. Not only do we have a legitimate inference to the contrary, but we have a direct holding from a jury based on credible evidence. The Erie had one obligation in this case to issue payment. It did. The jury found no breach. That finding of no breach is supported by credible evidence, and so we don't think we even get to the Kenosha home law applied by the circuit court judge.
How can Best Price be held to the contract that's between the insurer and the insured when Best Price wasn't a party to that contract, was never told those terms, and the jury was never informed that Best Price knew those terms?
This case is, like I said, you can't separate out the existence from the contract in this verbal contract, the existence of the contract from its terms. And so the jury heard testimony regarding Erie standard practice, and that Best Price didn't request a direct pay, and that Best Price was doing work for Erie's insured at its property. And so you have to look at it as a whole, so to not say, okay, we can consider all the evidence that Erie is involved in this case only because it has an insured who had a property damage claim.
What if the insurance company wasn't obligated to pay this at all?
If it wasn't a covered loss?
Right.
Erie wouldn't be involved.
Right. But Erie agreed to pay Best Price.
Only because it was called the property damage loss because it had
so
a contract.
So Best Price should have gotten the insurance contract, reviewed it to make sure that there was coverage, know the payment terms before it agreed to do the work on the property with the leaky pipe.
There is no indication in the record that Best Price didn't know it was dealing with an insurance company, or that it didn't realize that Erie had standard, that there are standard industry practices in a claim such as this, in a circumstance such as this.
If you were to win this case, what would the implications be, the consequences be in terms of future relations between insurers and contractors?
Not to enter into a contract, as found by the jury, and that compliance with your standard industry practices, there's a reason that they're standard industry practices. And so let insurance companies know we abide by our rules, and those rules that we follow will be upheld. Our actions will coincide with those rules. That makes sense.
So Best Price would have to enter into a contract with Trevor and his company?
Erie doesn't have the authority to act on behalf of its insured, to say, contractors, come in and fix this, this, and this in my insured's property. Erie's only there because it's a covered loss, and that it has an obligation to issue payment pursuant to its insurance company with its covered, with its, that's why it issues payment.
Is that the way the world works now?
Yes. You make a claim to your insurance company, and your insurance company comes in and hopefully pays for a covered loss.
Pays you, the insured.
I'm sorry?
Pays the insured.
The insurance company can pay the insured. It can also pay the contractor directly if there is a direction to pay.
From the insured.
Has to obtain. Because Erie, you can't ignore the fact that Erie has obligations to its insured.
Well, if that's the case, then they shouldn't issue two-party checks. They should just issue a check to the insured and tell Best Price, we won't pay you, but you're going to have to get the money from our insured.
It can issue payment directly to the contractor if it has a direction to pay. If the insured says we relinquish our right.
Okay.
But I'm dying to know, there is a second check in the briefs here and in the record to Najaco. What happened to that check?
Was not involved in that part of that dispute. It was also not part of the testimony that the jury heard. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Love?
The jury did hear about what happened to the second check. It was cashed by Trevor Trimble into his account. Then he claimed that he paid the HVAC person. As far as the issuance of a check is concerned, issuance by statute is defined to mean first delivery. So if I cut the check and drop it in the mail, I've issued it because that is the first delivery, and it doesn't, if it's either a non-holder or a holder, a mailman would be a non-holder.
Counsel, if you didn't ask that the jury be instructed on the state of the law with respect to when a contract does not define place of payment, that is, when it doesn't define place of payment, it goes to, in this instance, Best Price Plumbing. Have you waived that?
No, I didn't waive it. It's a matter of law that the place of payment is to be where if the contract is silent, is to be at the place where the contractor resides. That is not an issue of fact.
And the jury instruction. Tell the jury what the law is, that they're to apply to the facts so that they can reach a conclusion that is their verdict. And usually you want the jury to have the correct state of the law when they reach a conclusion. Here, there was no request that they know that part of the law.
No, the jury was not instructed, but it was still a matter of law that check had to be sent to my client's place of business, or if it was sent by Pony Express, or whether it was sent through the insurance hands, it had to arrive eventually to a position where my client could take the check for the obligation. I want to point out one very important fact before my time runs out. On April 9th, 2008, there was a request by the insured that the check be sent to him, and he conversed with Mr. Savitsky on that at Mr. Trimble's address. There was no discussion about what was the standard industry practice. Trevor Trimble asked for it, and there is no evidence on the record that this standard industry practice was ever communicated to Best Price. It was not a part of the agreement between them because there was no assent to such a practice. Because Savinsky didn't call up Best Price and said, I am sending this check to Trevor Trimble, goodbye, and my client didn't object, then we would have perhaps an issue. But there was no telephone call to Best Price that it was sending to Trimble, and it was a month later that my client started to send a nasty letter to Mr. Savinsky demanding that they get paid a separate check. Another thing I want to point out is that contracts are vague. They require interpretation as an issue of fact. Whether they are vague is an issue of law. And if a contract is indefinite, it means that there is no provision for it. But as has been stated, there is a default provision of the law as to place of payment if it's not placed in there. And in the case of Grimm, which is cited to the court in my brief, it explicitly states that custom does not modify this, and Erie's customs, therefore, do not modify what is a definite and unambiguous provision of the contract. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Love, and thank you, Ms. Bowlin. In yet another insurance case in a different format and perspective, and we appreciate your arguments and your briefs. That closes the argument on 10AP 1474, Best Price Plumbing, Inc. versus Erie Insurance Exchange. The court is in recess until tomorrow, when it will hear a fourth oral argument in its February calendar. And the court will meet in the conference room at 3:15. We are